The Movies, Films, and Flicks podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/shark. Over 150,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. What's going on, everyone? I'm your host, John Lossowoff. Welcome to another episode of Movies, Films, and Flicks. Let me introduce my co-host real quick, Mark Hoffmeyer.
You know, I'm feeling pretty good right now, guys. You know, I'm feeling invincible.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you just drink some type of liquid before doing this podcast?
Yeah, I picked up a guy who was hitchhiking, okay. And we ended up driving into this really crazy thing in Chinatown, and we got in a lot of big trouble in there.
Right.
I can't even tell you guys the stuff I saw down there, but that drink, it still got me flying high. I'm feeling mellow. I'm feeling good. I feel good about this.
Did you meet two girls with green eyes on this little excursion?
I did. I was too busy worrying about the immortal God and the guy that looked like Raiden chasing me to really focus on them. And then there was this weird bug that grabbed some ninjas from some cave, and we never saw them again. So I'm pretty on edge right now. Even, you know, it's a good thing I had that juice in me, some gummy juice, because I would need that to stay mellow.
That definitely sounds like an interesting story. Maybe one day you can retell the whole thing to us.
Yeah, I mean, just come on up, visit. I'll sit you guys. We'll sit in a circle, and we'll just talk.
Yeah. Well, you'll retell this fascinating story about the time you ran into some trouble when you had visited Chinatown.
Yeah. Well, I skipped my workout today, but I am wearing no sleeves like the Grandmaster Kurt Russell himself. Right. And if I wasn't here with you guys, I'd probably be doing my Kurt Russell arms workout, which would probably just be doing like farm work.
No, yeah, just carrying
arms.
I want to ask my other co-host, John Lemongood, what shenanigans did you get into before getting into the podcast tonight?
Being just a few miles from Mexico at the very bottom tip of Texas, I'm drinking one of the real Four Locos that you're not supposed to be able to get in the States anymore.
Oh, really? What's the real Four Loco for those not in the know?
It just still has the cranked up caffeine in it, along with the really high alcohol content in a can that's probably too big at 24 ounces.
Yeah. So you're trying to hit the Jason Statham level of crank.
Yeah, like one of these cans is basically 4 6% beers. It's 24 ounces of 12 ounces of alcohol, and it's cranked with caffeine. That's why they banned it. I think kids were chugging it or something. Right. But I'm twice the size as one of those kids who are chugging it, so I should make it at least halfway through the podcast before I degenerate.
Well, how about this for the listeners of this podcast? As the podcast is going along, see if Lemongood becomes more or less coherent.
If it becomes sound more British.
Or you pull like an Anna Faris, and you go full on Borat.
It's like, I think the Four Locos kicking in.
So two things before we start. What is the Kurt Russell workout? Do you just put drywall over your head and walk around with it? Do you like, you know, when you put some cement in a bucket and then you put that metal pole in it, do you just swing that in a circle?
I wrap a chain around three cinder blocks and I curl it.
Nice.
I think it involves knocking yourself out during like a critical moment of the workout.
So in the middle of one of John's hack squats, he knocks himself out, but going for the world record, not like a regular hack squat.
But yet somehow he manages to pull through.
and then number two, Anne Faris. That movie, The House Bunny, it's underrated.
Was that the one where she was a playmate?
No, it was What's Your Number, though, was the one where she went full on Borat on the date with the British guy. And as she drank more and more, she went from a Southern English accent to a Cockney to full on Borat.
She's good. She needs to be in probably like Interstellar 2 or something.
I think she's married to Chris Pratt, actually.
Yeah.
A little Hollywood gossip going in there.
A little Hollywood gossip?
I don't know if it's gossip. Haven't they been married for years?
Hey, I'm not into that type of thing. Maybe you are living good. I don't know. Speaking of gossip, Mark, do you have any gossip from our listeners?
Yeah. So last week, Levin Good, the horror Leviathan who surfs the waves and watches Hellraiser 3 on his portable DVD player, culled some questions from Twitter, and they gave us a wonderful time where we discussed Michael Myers, Jason, Knives, ShamWows. It was glorious. So this year, this pod, I took questions from our Facebook page, the Movies, Films, and Flicks Facebook page.
Like it if you haven't already.
And our first question was from Lacey. And she asks, what would be the most evenly matched female superhero versus female supervillain battle?
Oh, can I go first on this one?
Yeah.
Actually, for the female supervillain, this one is kind of cheating because I felt like you guys might think it was an easy choice. But I'm going, did you guys ever see My Super Ex-Girlfriend with Uma Thurman?
Yeah, Anna Faris.
Yeah, exactly.
No gossip.
Yeah, for those of you who haven't seen the movie, Luke Wilson, dates Uma Thurman's character, but he has no idea she's actually a superhero in real life, or like her alter ego is a superhero. He dumps her, and she ends up spending the rest of the movie terrorizing Luke Wilson just because he dumped her, using her superhero powers to just, get back at him, right?
Wait, did you pick this because this is you're with Shark Dropper podcast?
No.
And at one point she literally drops a shark into his apartment in New York.
No, but that's a good connection. Anyway, but no, I
next week
I think she's the ultimate kind of clingy ex-girlfriend, right? She just won't let Luke Wilson go. And the reason why I picked her as a supervillain, because it's in great contrast to my female superhero. And she didn't really play a superhero in traditional sense, but she was a badass anyway. I'm going with Zoe Bell in Death Proof.
Whoa!
Yeah, exactly. If you haven't seen Death Proof, it's Quentin Tarantino made a movie with Kurt Russell, obviously.
Kurt Russell's everywhere.
Plays a killer stuntman who terrorizes a group of girls, and this group includes Rosario Dawson and Zoe Bell. There's a scene towards the end of the movie where it's like stuntman Mike, played by Kurt Russell, is terrorizing the girls, and Zoe Bell is hanging on the hood of the car. And the whole time, Kurt Russell's just ramming into the car. And, the whole time, Zoe Bell is just, hanging on for dear life, and she just would not budge. So, basically, you have Uma Thurman, the clingy ex-girlfriend, going against Zoe Bell, the ultimate clinger.
Like Kurt Russell, she must have great grip strength, because that's what it comes down to when it comes down to holding onto a car while it's getting rammed. That's grip strength.
She probably does 500-pound deadlifts. No problem.
She probably does.
I think Zoe would win because I think Uma eventually would be like, I like you. I like you. I threw a shark. You grabbed onto the shark. You flew 200 miles. You held onto the shark.
It would just, they would just be engaging in a cling off for 5 hours.
I love it. No, that's good. My Super Ex-Girlfriend. I totally forgot that movie existed. It's like a chill factor or Hard Rain.
Yeah, it's not going to win any Oscars, but it's not a bad movie either. It's a movie you watch when you're bored on a Thursday night.
I do it on Tuesdays, but that's just me.
Right.
So, John, what do you got?
Well, a couple episodes back, you had mentioned Lucy at 27%, so that she wouldn't be like God Lucy. Scarlett Johansson Lucy. And so and I was thinking about that, and I realized I think I could pit 100% Lucy against the Dark Phoenix, Jean Grey, when she turns evil, because Dark Phoenix has power over time. So does Lucy. Dark Phoenix has power over matter. She can just disintegrate anything she wants to that's in front of her, whereas Lucy can usually manifest things that are in front of her rather than disintegrate them or manipulate them. They're both telekinetic. I think that would be an interesting matchup because they both have almost godly unstoppable powers.
But then how would you win that kind of fight?
I don't know. That's why you watch the fight. If everyone knew who would win between between Mike Tyson and Buster Douglas, then they wouldn't go to the show, would they? They want to see the fight. I'm sorry. That might be a little bit of an old reference for our listeners. That was from like 20 years ago. But whatever. Manny Pacquiao and Floyd Mayweather. Like, if you knew who was going to win, you wouldn't buy a ticket, would you?
I just feel like that fight, the only result you'll get is the destruction of the entire universe.
if you mean a Floyd wins, Mayweather everybody beats Pacquiao. Loses.
Well, I was talking about the sure, Mayweather and Pacquiao. Yeah, whoever wins just results in the destruction of the universe.
Now, can the cornerman be Ian McKellen as Magneto and Morgan Freeman?
Well, sure.
Why is not? He Morgan Freeman from Bruce Almighty?
Yeah, so God and Magneto. I love it. So, guys, listen to this. All right, I'm gonna lay something on you here, and I want to see what you think about it. So, Lilu from Fifth Element.
Okay.
Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Oh. Selene from Underworld. Elektra from Elektra. Sith from Thor and Black Widow versus Catwoman. Elektra from Daredevil, the one where they battle on the playground. Deathstrike from X2. Mystique, Rebecca Romijn, not Jennifer Lawrence. The Baroness from G.I. Joe. And see, it's the good guys attacking Mama's high-rise from Dread. So, yeah, Lilu, Buffy, Selene, Elektra, Sith, and Black Widow attacking Mama's high-rise in Dread, and they have to fight Catwoman, Elektra, Deathstrike, Mystique, and Baroness.
What would be an interesting twist is if during the fight, Mama from the movie Mama was haunting and stalking them.
So I would give if Mama's joining the evil side, it's got to go to the bad people. Because, I mean, Deathstrike, she's basically Wolverine. Mystique is a shapeshifter. So I don't really see the good guys having too much of a chance against the bad guys.
I don't know. I think I want to see this movie. I'm not sure what would be going on.
I think it would be like the Raid Redemption, but with superheroes and with the Mama Ghost creeping around.
Who would win? The Mama Ghost or Buffy the Vampire Slayer?
That's kind of tough to say, though, right? Because, like, in all these movies where ghosts are killing people or haunting people, like, the ghost can physically manipulate you and hurt you, but usually the people, they can't, like, hurt the ghost.
Now, let's say we're in a parallel universe with Sarah Michelle Gellar, where she was in that one, The Grudge. Did she beat up the ghost?
I want to say no. I feel like they always ran from the ghost until they resolved what the ghost's motivation was. I don't remember those Grudge movies, but it's not like people were – because when a ghost scares you, if it comes around the corner and scares you, like, think about it. You're a bro. You might run and be scared, but you'd probably pop the thing in the nose first. But you never see in the movie where the nose is like, oh shit. Like, the ghost never gets popped in the nose in the movies.
See, I think I'm going to have to go with Buffy. The reason being because I feel like Joss Whedon will come up with some clever plot device for Buffy to come through and save the day.
Yeah, she finds like the secret stake of Almodor.
Yeah.
And then she puts it through the portal of Shemansky.
Yeah.
And it kills Mama.
And then she makes out with Angel, David Boreanaz.
I gotta disagree because Joss Whedon decided to kill Thor in Cabin in the Woods, man. Wow. I mean, yeah. I don't think he'll have any sympathy for Sarah Michelle Gellar. I don't care what involvement he had in that show.
He wipes some people out.
I don't know. If it's Buffy, I think he might I think he has a soft spot for her. So, that's all I'm saying.
So this is a random aside, but if you guys saw that movie Mama, the horror film with Jessica Chastain and Jaime Lannister...
starring Game of Thrones Jaime Lannister.
Yeah. Now, at the end, spoiler, he takes this little girl or Mama takes this little girl and they jump off a cliff and they turn into leaves. And then Jessica Chastain and
nothing, yeah.
Yeah, and then Jessica Chastain and Jaime walk away. So, how would they explain to people the disappearance of this child?
Hold on, before you answer the question, it's like I didn't see the movie. But I'm wondering if when they turn the leaves, did someone in the background go, oh, man, I think it's time for you to leave.
Dude.
Oh,
dude.
Oh,
Oh. Go sit in the corner. You're out of the rest of this episode. Okay.
All right.
Well, that was in the director's cut, actually. Jack Black did a cameo, and he said that.
It's time for you guys to leave.
Time for you to leave.
And then turn into leaves.
That's like Sylvester Stallone from the 80s. You know, time for you to leave.
Yeah.
But is there a lengthy court battle? If Mama had a sequel, would it be like if the glove doesn't exist, then the
prosecution can't persist? Like the OJ, if the glove don't fit, we must acquit.
Yeah, so I guess since they left those questions, it was a success because I'm still asking them, but I don't know.
I mean, they say that exposition is the death of horror, and when you explain too much, like the whole thing falls apart for our interests. So maybe this is why they don't give you those answers. I mean, some people say that the reason Michael Myers was so terrifying was because even though we know that he was a killer in the movie, in the first movie, we didn't know what was driving him. And that made it terrifying. It made him unpredictable, other than the fact that he was trying to kill Jamie Lee Curtis. So, I mean, when you explain too much, like Rob Zombie's Halloween, people criticize for over-explaining, right? And I think that's just it. If you over-explain it, it falls apart.
It's like naming the ghost from Paranormal Activity Toby.
And then giving him a cult in part four with this huge elaborate.
So, all right, here we go. Going back to this question that we have, I'm thinking that everybody dies, right? But the two people left alive are Black Widow, and she is going to be squaring off against Mystique.
Wait, but Widow is like the least superpowered of people on both teams.
Lulu has like no, like she'll just be running into it. She'll go headlong into it, meet Deathstrike and die. Buffy will probably, I don't know, Joss Whedon kills her off.
Oh no.
Celine gets killed by Deathstrike. Sith goes down against Baroness and Elektra. Black Widow kills Catwoman because they're both human. And then Mama, I don't know, she just does those drugs and falls off the building. And that leaves it up to Black Widow and Mystique, and then cut to black, so you don't know who wins.
That was elaborate. Was that enough steps to connect to Kevin Bacon?
Man, I'm trying to think.
And a person telling this story got kneed in the balls in a room with Kevin Bacon.
Wait, I got it. Mystique, Kevin Bacon was in X-Men First Class, and Mystique was in that.
There you go. Okay, one degree to Kevin Bacon.
That's right. So, but thank you guys. Thank you for those questions, Lacey and Jonathan. We appreciate you asking them. And guys, if you have any questions, just get on us on Twitter, Movies, Films, and Flicks, our Facebook. Give us some random questions. We'll have fun answers for you.
Yeah, don't be afraid to get really weird. You know, the weirder the question, the more fun it is to answer.
Like, what would happen if David Spade was a star of Boogie Nights? You know, like ask.
Well, he definitely wouldn't have had that closing scene where he's saying, "I'm a star in front of the mirror." Oh,
I think I want to see that movie now. And I just realized I'll never be able to watch it.
Never.
Thanks a lot, guys.
What a terrible fate.
All right. Moving on to the meat of the podcast. Right, guys. On your website, Movies, Films, and Flicks, you guys had a special week dedicated to the year 1995. Am I right?
That's true. Mark, do you want to kind of talk about that for a second before I get into the article?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I'm 32. So, obviously, I was, 12, 13 when 95 came around. And, I don't know, I grew up with a lot of these movies. When I was 13, I was watching Kids 7, A Kid in King Arthur's Court, Jumanji, Sense and Sensibility, Braveheart. And so, I don't know, I feel like I've grown up as a movie lover, as a fan of films from 1995. So what I did was, and John and I, my wife Megan, my cousin Ham Sandwich, we all got together, we wrote posts, and we just did a big 1995 spectacular where we covered Clerks, Mallrats, Dracula Dead and Loving It. We did The Biggest Jerks. We did The Best Fights, The Best Monsters. And it was just a lot of fun, and a lot of people responded to it. And John wrote a really Levengood, the horror Leviathan, who surfs on the waves and watches a Portal DVD player with Hellraiser 2, wrote a post about 1995 horror. And 1995 horror was garbage. There were some gems, but John really kind of captured the essence in his post.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, every year in horror, you've got the great films like The Conjuring or the first in the Saw series. You have those typically kind of murder-by-numbers, trope-rich movies like Nightmare on Elm Street Part 4, 5, Freddy's Dead. And then you have all those direct-to-DVD releases like the Puppet Master movies. So the well really ran dry in 1995. I mean, for horror fans, it really wouldn't have been a good time to be a horror fan in 1995. So I put together 10 of my favorite moments of 1995. Basically, these moments are just like iconic things that happened in movies, and they're in no particular order. And so here we go. So my first pick for 1995 horror is actually hardly a horror at all. It's Species. And Species managed to do two things that really terrified men. It kind of made a horror version of the coming of age of a woman with this chrysalis scene. And it also pulled the praying mantis killing the guy after sex, after she transformed into a not much sexy anymore tentacle monster from H.R. Giger's Alien imagination. And so that movie really affected me. Obviously, I saw that movie. I was 14. I'm 34 now. And it's cool because that movie is actually a lot like an exploitation flick masquerading as a high-budget summer special effects release.
I mean, they had Oscar winners in there.
They did, yeah. They had Alfred Molina. They had Ben Kingsley. They had Michael well, Michael Madsen's no Oscar winner.
But he was normal. He was like Gary Busey in Lethal Weapon back, you know, or Rookie of the Year. He was normal. Like, he was a leading man.
I mean, when he was sober, you mean.
You know, yeah. What else is interesting about this movie in the exploitation sense is that Natasha Henstridge, who did go on to have a career after this, even though it wasn't, like, you know, an A-lister career, she got breast implants just for this job and openly talked about it in interviews about this movie before it was released. I remember all this clearly.
I had no idea she got breast implants for this movie.
Huh. Yeah, it was for this movie.
Wow. You know what I think is interesting about this film is you have these, like, aliens who live light years from Earth. They can travel between the stars. But when you finally meet them, they're just really gross and juicy. And, it's just weird that they can figure all this stuff out and have this form. But then when they do show them true selves, they're just really gross.
Yeah.
Well, they're gross to us. I mean, dogs look really cute to one another, but, like, I don't want to go kiss a dog.
So you're saying you're Hank the alien, and you're looking at Charisse the alien, and you're thinking, all right.
Yeah.
And I think that, like, Charisse might catch me looking at Alien Playboy at Syl, or Natasha Henstridge's character, and, like, be like, don't you be looking at her?
I saw you looking at her tentacle.
Yeah, I saw you looking at her tentacle.
It's just such a... I don't think they make movies like this too much anymore. Just these A-list actors in total trash. I mean, has there been a film like this? Like Hollow Man, they did – well, Verhoeven. Has there been a movie like this recently?
Not that went to theaters. I mean, this was a major summer release.
No, there was – I think there's a resurgence of that, right? If you – a movie that's been mentioned on here before, Snowpiercer, that's a – that had a pretty decent cast, right?
But that had no level of an exploitative nature to the movie. That was a serious, thought-provoking, interesting, geeky movie. Like, they had a lot of interesting components in it.
I think some of the action and violence was a little exploitive.
I think they were just channeling the Korean action movies.
I just can't think of like an R-rated alien film with an A-list cast.
Yeah. That's true.
Unless it's Nick Cage, if he's still A-list.
I don't know. I think the thing that makes this movie shine, though, in that otherwise crappy year is, again, this really is, like, think about how many scenes you see breasts in it. This is a sexy exploitation movie, and it somehow got away with not being recognized as it.
And I think, you know, you're 13, 14, you watch this movie, it kind of gets burnt in your memory. Like, you
it's life-changing. It was life-changing.
Yeah. I mean, you think it's kind of the coolest. I think that's, you know, I guess that's why, like, a lot of these 95 films, I'm not saying because of that, but just like Braveheart and all these, you're kind of in your formative years of watching movies and you're kind of in like Mallrats. Like you learn like Brody from Mallrats. And like, I don't know, I guess all these movies have really stuck with me because this is when I really like jumped headlong in the cinema was 95. So even if it was decent, I still love it because I feel like that was just the year for it.
Yeah. Well, continuing and harvesting the best moments of horror in 1995, we move on to The Prophecy. And for me, it's all about Christopher Walken as the fallen Archangel Gabriel. And in this, he has this one move, this special power, where he puts his fingers over his lips, holds his two fingers up in front of his target, and he says, "Shh," and they just die. It was the coolest thing ever when he would do that. And in one scene, he actually, after he hushed them to death, he walks away and he does it again, holding his hand behind his back, and the body catches on fire. Like, What a badass of horror in a bad year of horror. Like, Christopher Walken.
Imagine if he was like your substitute teacher.
Oh man! And you think you're gonna act out, right?
Oh, you got like some, you know, you have the class clown acting up, and all of a sudden that happens, and he blows up.
And then there's some like man child of a bully who's the size of a fifth grader in third grade. He just gets hushed and incinerated. All the kids are like, "Shit, Billy, we better behave." And Stop throwing pencils.
Viggo Mortensen was good in The Prophecy as well.
He made a hell of a straight-faced Lucifer. Like, yeah. He was pretty creepy, man. No one even knew who it was back then. He wasn't even big time. He's sitting there perched. He looks down when he talks. He's letting you know that ruling hell has really taken its toll on him. But he's still tough. Don't mess with Lucifer.
But, like, he's kind of seen it all, so he doesn't need to be swaggering around. Like, he doesn't need to – you know, they didn't need Sylvester Stallone for that role.
Yeah, it's very much. And you know what else? Like, so the movie Species kind of, in a weird way, is a ripoff of, like, older exploitative movies. In 20 years, The Prophecy has never been properly ripped off or sampled by other movies like so many other themes do, except for the sequels in the Prophecy series.
Oh, so it's due for a remake is what you're saying.
Oh, God, don't say that out loud. Someone's going to hear this and do some Kickstarter campaign. Don't remake it.
So, like, Fassbender is the devil.
I guess he'd make a good devil.
I can't think of a... And just bring Walken back again, because I love him.
Yeah, why? You can't recast Walken.
So, next on my list is actually... It's not as good as the original movie, but I picked it anyway. It was Candyman Farewell to the Flesh, which was the second of the Candyman movies. But this sequel, not quite as much as the original Candyman, but these movies, they made bees really, really creepy. Bees never had a properly creepy scene except for when Christopher Lee was in the original Wicker Man, and that old movie is slow as hell to watch. But Candyman, you know, he's got bees on his rib cage, which is exposed and has flesh being picked off of it. He's got bees coming out of his mouth when they're filming this movie. I mean, it was just so off-putting. Like, not since only Case 39 did a good job with the yellow jacket scene with Bradley Cooper, where the yellow jackets are coming out of like his eye sockets, like from under his eyelids.
Oh, that'd be the worst.
Oh God! And then they were all over his back, and he ended up dying. But like. No movie has really done honor to the creepiness of bees like Candyman did. So that was kind of like the highlight of Candyman and the sequel was these bee scenes because the actors really had the bees on them.
I love what Roger Ebert said about this movie. He's like, I am left with questions. Why did Candyman visit Chicago? Why did he prey on innocent victims who had done him no wrong? Which is he, a mythical force brought to reality by psychic mind power or an immortal being fueled by the life force of the bees who lives in mirrors? I spend my days pondering questions such as these so you don't have to. Well, because didn't they kill him by putting honey on him and then having the bees attack?
And then a bear comes.
Well, I think in response to that, in the words of our very own horror Leviathan, exposition is the death of horror. So you don't need to explain that.
Yeah. If you were to explain that he was a beekeeper and back when he was like alive before he was the ghostly Candyman,
it would just
all of a sudden you'd be like, "It's stupid! It's stupid! Yeah. These bees!
I hate every single one of these stupid bees."
So, Next on my list was the remake of Village of the Damned. And Village of the Damned did one big thing in 1995. They proved that in 35 years between 1960 and 1995, very little had changed. We still find blonde kids that don't smile, don't say a lot, and stare are creepy as hell.
I mean, I would still feel that today, 20 years now. If there's a little blonde bomber walking around my house staring at me, I'm going to be a little freaked out.
Do you think that when they made the original Village of the Damned, they were thinking of, like, Third Reich youth? Because they're all these overly disciplined little blonde kids?
Wow.
Whoa. I think you just went deep on us.
I mean,
we don't know where
sure.
to go.
Is it me? I mean, the original came out in 1960. It wasn't that far afterwards.
Right.
You know, it's like, and all these kids, they're almost militantly rigid in their behavior. This strikes me as the old black and white videos of the school age youth.
You know what the one thing was that annoyed me about Village of the Dam is I was annoyed that even when I was younger, that the same guy who made The Thing made this. I was like,
you know, maybe he just needed a paycheck. He might have had some tough times. I don't know what's going on with him. He might have gone through divorce. Maybe he got his maid pregnant. I don't know. I don't know what's going on. And all of a sudden, like, he's thinking back, shit, last week, my manager Morty called me. He's like, are you going to remake Village of the Damned? I said, no, screw off. And then I found out my wife is leaving me. I'm going to have an ex-wife. I got my maid pregnant. I need this paycheck. Give me Village of the Damned.
We do not endorse the viewpoints. No, I'm joking. No, I mean, it definitely was a paycheck job because if you watch some of his others, maybe he did this to make Escape from L.A.
Maybe, yeah. Ooh. Who knows? Yeah, maybe it's like, you know what, John? We don't like Escape from L.A., but if you do this remake for us back, yep. And that was back in the day when remakes weren't old hat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they thought it was hot.
One for the studio, one for me.
Yeah, no, and, you know, that happened a lot. So speaking of one for the studio, one for me, I don't know where this next pick came from. This next pick was like the dark horse of 1995 in the movie I never saw coming. Tales from the Crypt presents Demon Knight.
Yes.
Now that movie, which, by the way, featured the most charming Billy Zane role ever. I think Billy Zane was channeling this role when he did Zoolander. But he seemed so persuasive. He could have talked me into anything. And I almost want to think, like, as he's trying to lure people out of this house to be eaten alive by these slimy demons that look like the Terror at 20,000 feet from Twilight Zone, like, imagine if you swapped that Billy Zane with the Billy Zane from Titanic and imagine how the two movies would have ended.
I mean, if there was a demonic cowboy running around the Titanic, I would love that, actually.
Yeah, and if there was, like, a sniveling shit, like, wandering around with the demons. Like, you couldn't persuade anyone to do anything. They'd be like, you're just a dick. I'm not going to come out of the house so you can kill me.
You're just a jerk. Please, guys, please. I got these demons here. No, but, like, Tales from the... It's funny. Like, in that Demon Knight, there's that scene where the woman punches the demon in the face, and she's like, oh, I'm sorry. It's just, like, funny. And what I like about it is Ernest Dickerson directed it. He did a lot of The Walking Dead now, and he just kind of instilled it with a lot of good character pieces. You got Roach the jerk. You have just a lot of the different Jada Pinkett. There were fully formed characters in this film, and they all got their moments. And I liked how just creepy and atmospheric and cheeky it was. I mean, it had its tongue in cheek, but it also really had some good practical gore.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that movie. It worked. It was a weird kind of shooting from the hip style movie, but I agree. I think it worked.
I was a huge Tales from the Crypt fan back. Well, I still am, and it just boggles my mind that they actually made two Tales from the Crypt movies. They weren't. The second one wasn't all that great, but this one was actually fun. It's a Tales from the Crypt movie. What more do you want?
Yeah. And I think it nailed being a Tales of the Crypt movie.
Yeah, and like Tales from the Crypt episodes, like almost I feel like half the episodes had some gratuitous nudity. This movie had that one scene where the guy from – wasn't it the guy from Gremlins, the neighbor from Gremlins?
Yeah.
Where he has this fantasy, like Billy Zane takes him to this fantasy, and he's surrounded by like 30 Playboy playmates that are topless. Yeah. It's like, so,
oh,
like
– God.
Yeah, that's like the only scene of nudity, but it's like they are power drilling the nudity into you.
Yeah, it was just a good. I don't know. I think one thing that's good about it is it has a personality. It knew what it was, and it just told a different type story, a different origin type story, and it was successful at that. I like the blood goo that could block doors, and I bought this movie on VHS on Columbia House.
Way back in the day.
I had on VHS from Columbia House.
It was the complete opposite of its sequel, Bordello of Blood, the one with Dennis Miller.
Oh, you can call that a sequel. Don't you dare. Don't you soil the sanctity of Demon Knight like that.
I don't think I can if I want to. But
So Mark had commented that it seemed like Demon Knight, you know, it was its own thing. It really stood out. It was... We'll loosely call it original even, but another movie kind of like that stood out to me was Lord of Illusions. Lord of Illusions was to horror in the 90s what the Prestige was to drama in the 2000s. It took kind of a motif that no one was really touching on in movies and introduced us to the world of magic and illusion performers. It used Scott Bakula from Quantum Leap. It had a nice, likable character. And, I mean, this movie was cool. It really kind of pulled the curtain on the great and powerful Oz of horror and magicians and illusionists. And something interesting that happens in this movie, which really does take a true supernatural horror magical angle, is... This performer is doing a trick, and he calls it the sword trick, where he's rotating on this table, and swords are randomly dropping from a spinning chandelier. And of course, just like the knife trick in an old carnival act, the swords are supposed to consistently miss him, but ooh and ah the audience. But during this scene, something goes wrong, and the swords start piercing his body as they fall from the ceiling and killing him. And then, of course, later in the movie, it turns out that he staged this and it was real magic and all this shit and he wanted to disappear. But when you watch this movie, which, God, it's so impressive. It's a sin that it was forgotten. When you watch this scene, you are just reeling. And one of the coolest things about this movie is that people don't know about it. So you got to find Lord of Illusions. This was a theatrical release in 1995, and it got forgotten the very next year like it was a direct-to-video release. I mean, did either of you guys see Lord of Illusions?
Yeah, I mean, what I like about it the most is that it gives you exactly what you want. There's in a horror film, you got the magic, you got the blood, you got Clive Barker tearing it up. And I just remember liking the detective story of it. It was different. I think it is a little bit of a lost classic, but I just kind of liked it. It's worth your money. I mean, if you're a gore hound, there's plenty of that. There's a decent story. There's something different. There's Hugh Jackman clones, which is always good.
Nice.
And you know what else? The movie wasn't predictable. I haven't seen the movie in a long time, and even just talking about it, I almost found myself just mumbling a word salad as I was bombarded with all these different memories of this movie, and they really stand out because this movie isn't a cookie-cutter formulaic horror movie. It really it went to its own tune from start to finish. Oh. The only predictable thing about it was that, yeah, there was real magic going on because you got this in the horror section of your local DVD rental place.
Well, I just think Clive Barker's movies aren't that accessible to the mainstream. I think they're more cult audiences. I mean, is Hellraiser, when that came out, was that a massive hit?
It's probably like his most mainstream.
I don't know if it was a massive hit, but in the long run, it became one.
Yeah, his movies like Nightbreed, that's now a cult classic, Hellraiser. I think his movies have just... I don't know. I think they're more – I don't think they're so far outside the mainstream and different and tough and unpredictable that I could see them failing in the theaters and picking up cult audiences later on.
Yeah, and yet they really are, though. They're so cool because he is such a fantastic – not just wordsmith as a writer, but he'll put together these fantastical horror scenarios. Again, they're incomparable. I mean, he's like Stephen King, but he's a little younger and edgier.
Mm-hmm. Oh, maybe we should do a Clive Barker podcast one of these days. Maybe.
Well, now to get a little back to the mainstream, and this is not to use a taboo word, but this is a bit of a blaxploitation movie, is Tales from the Hood, which was an anthology horror movie in 1995 with, you know, like any other horror anthology like Creepshow. But all three stories revolved around an African-American cast and or African-American themes. And one of those particular shorts was about evil dolls. They were about evil slave dolls. And I got to say, I think that Tales from the Hood took it too far. I've got these images on the website. But these slave dolls, they look a little too racist to me. I don't know how to put it better than that. This movie was made mostly by black people, but I think that the dolls look too racist. I don't know how to put it. That stuck out to me. That's something that I remembered from the 90s. And when I went looking it up, when I was preparing to talk about it today, I was thinking the same thing, looking at these images. I feel like they went too far.
It actually, you talking about Tales from the Hood brings up a specific memory I have. When I went to go visit an older cousin, like he was in high school at the time and I was still in grade school, he had just gone to Blockbuster and brought back two movies, Species and Tales from the Hood. So
that's a great movie night.
I had a double header with those two movies, and it's just like I saw those two movies, I'm just like, man, those two movies just forever entwined together in my head, even though they're just there's nothing in common between those two movies. I don't know. I remember being really, really amused by Tales from the Hood and being really kind of having weird feelings about Species. I'm like, oh.
It was your coming of age viewer experience.
Sure. I don't want to go into details, but yeah, let's just leave it at that.
All right. Well, to take it from a less edgy note, next up, I had Vampire in Brooklyn. So Vampire in Brooklyn, I noticed something very charming about this movie, and I didn't notice it back when I saw it. This is Eddie Murphy in a horror comedy as a vampire. All right, fine. Well, if you were to get the movie cover, the movie poster for the movie Boomerang, which was a romantic comedy starring Eddie Murphy, and then get the movie poster for Vampire in Brooklyn and put them side by side, it almost looks like the same exact director and the same exact cover artist were working together to make these movie covers, because Eddie Murphy is in the same position. He has a similar, like, hand position under his chin. He's got the woman to his left in the same exact position. You got the city in a silhouette at night underneath them. And it's like these are almost the same movie, but one's a horror comedy and one's a romantic comedy.
I think they just saw Vampire in Brooklyn, and they're like, we got to get people in the theater somehow. And so they just used the Boomerang poster, because that was a good movie. And then they used, they switched it over to this, a Vampire in Brooklyn.
But, you know, you say that, but these movies came out really close to one another. These movies might have, in fact, been in theaters overlapping together for all. I don't really remember, but, I mean, they're both 1995 releases.
You know what I was thinking about with Vampire in Brooklyn? He's like a vampire. It's like those Santa Claus movies where he needs to find a spouse or he dies. But that kind of goes against all things vampires.
Yeah, they're usually somewhere at a rave wearing black leather.
They have to be at a rave.
Yeah.
But like that goes against like immortality. It's like, oh, hey, I guess I gotta go find a wife now. And then like he goes and finds this really great detective. She has this nice partner. He tries to woo her by like picking her up in a stretch limo, and I never saw her falling for this guy. And he's the villain though, because he wants to turn her into a vampire, but she's like this great cop. And so the whole time I'm like, I just didn't know who to like, who to root for. I was like a very conflicted 14-year-old watching this film. I'm like, don't do it, Angela Bassett.
Okay, so well, Vampire in Brooklyn and Tales from the Hood were kind of what I just call typical horror comedies, even if they push the envelope a little bit. But my last two picks, and we can almost talk about them intertwined together, they really went slapstick. I've got Clint Howard's The Ice Cream Man, and I have The Granny. Now, both of these movies, if you were to do a Google image search for The Granny or Ice Cream Man, you would find a maelstrom of idiotically inane pictures of gore and silliness. I mean, the movie poster for The Granny has some woman in a torn up dress with some evil granny in the background. It looks like she's holding a shotgun, like she's the Terminator or something. You got The Ice Cream Man, You got Clint Howard, who's the king of horrible horror cameos. And he's got an ice cream cone with the guy's head on it as one of the popular images that you'll pick up on a Google image search.
Is that ice cream or is it like I'm looking at the movie poster where he has an ice cream cone and then there's ice cream in the shape of a skull.
Right. Yeah. But yeah, if you were to do a Google image search for this movie, you'd actually see him with a giant waffle cone and a man's severed head on the cone as like the first scoop of ice cream and then more ice cream on top of it. Like it was multiple scoops of ice cream.
I mean, you got to give him props for really going with his gimmick. Like he's not self-conscious about it. I mean, just finding that waffle cone that size, like he is committed to being the ice cream truck killer.
Like, yeah. Did he make that waffle cone himself? Did he just like make the batter? And like,
that had to be a special cone suited for a man's head that would weigh about 8 pounds. I mean,
according to Jerry Maguire,
and it's not the first waffle cone that he's made. So, you know, he's put some time into it.
Yeah, but I mean, this movie was like the Ginger Dead Man and the Evil Bong. But like a decade before those ridiculous movies, like so 1995 really helped spawn, and the years around 1995, to be honest, helped spawn these ridiculous horror movies that were straight to DVD.
I mean, so, I love this ice cream cone I'm looking at. I'm pretty obsessed with it right now.
I think we have to honor you. Did you find a picture of the one with the severed head?
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now. And I'm also looking at the ice cream that he shaped into a skull.
Oh, man.
Now, one movie that I haven't seen that you added in here was Halloween 5 or 6. It was Halloween.
The Curse of Michael Myers, I think.
Yeah, The Curse of Michael Myers. Now, talk about exposition is the death of horror. In 5 and 6, they tried to explain that Michael Myers was part, there's a man in black, and there was a cult that made him immortal.
And he can't die.
Yeah, and he impregnated his cousin, I think, something like that. And Paul Rudd made his starring debut in it. I think when they open up the movie, they're like, introducing Paul Thomas Rudd. And I don't know. But I've been reading a lot about it, and they have a producer's cut and a director's cut. So I guess the movies were doomed from the beginning. And then, like, I don't know. I just love the fact that they tried to make Michael Myers some cult figure. And then another movie with Renee Zellweger and Matthew McConaughey, that Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Next Generation, filmed at 94. It was supposed to come out in 95, but McConaughey and Zellweger fought it, and then it came out later. But in that movie, it said that druids were in control of Leatherface, and Matthew really? McConaughey was a cannibal with a robotic leg. So, like, 95 was big with, like, cults.
Oh, really? And
I'll bet the people who made the Paranormal 3 and 4 and on movies, they probably were watching horror movies back in 1995. And then that's where they got their horrible Toby cult idea.
Oh, gosh. But I just love that these two classic, Leatherface and Michael Myers, the longer they're around, the more they try to explain them. And then eventually you're just like, oh, brother. And yeah. And then there's actually a scene where Michael runs in Halloween 6.
Oh, that's already how you know it's a bullshit movie. Michael Myers doesn't run.
No, he's the slowest on all of them.
Well, he would lose a foot race against a sloth on the ground.
Well, listen, guys, sloths are tricking you. If sloths are really that slow, they would all be gone. They would all be dead. So if you see a sloth, don't go anywhere near it, because that slow thing is just a gag. It wants to lure you in to kill you.
that's how they get their prey.
Yeah.
Well, I think sloths is a good point to wrap up 95 horror, right? I can't think of a scarier entity than a sloth.
What better all-encompassing theme than the speed of the sloth could wrap up this particular discussion point? I mean, sloths just bring it all together.
Yeah. I think I'm going to look up YouTube videos of sloths real quick. No, let's just take a break, and I'm going to look at cute little sloths and their terrifying eyes.
They are not cute.
We'll be back in a little bit.
Hey, y'all, it's Mark. And for you, the listeners of Movies, Films, and Flicks, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. Now, there's a book that I really recommend to you guys. And since we've been talking about horror films tonight, It's a book called Shock Value, How a Few Eccentric Outsiders Gave Us Nightmares, Conquered Hollywood, and Invented Modern Horror. It's a wonderful book. It's about 9 hours long, but it walks you through how Alien, Halloween, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, how the classics were made, Rosemary's Baby. And if you're a fan of horror, if you're a cinephile, and if you're just a fan of classic cinema, I totally recommend Shock Value. It's a wonderful book by Jason Zinnemann. Totally recommend it. So to download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/shark. Again, that's audibletrial.com/shark for your free audiobook.
Welcome back to Movies, Films, and Flicks, everyone. That was a pretty entertaining break. I watched about a ton of sloth videos on YouTube, and I think I'm ready to jump right back in. What about you guys?
I'm in a bad place.
Are you? You should. Did you watch the sloth videos with me?
Yeah, it's terrifying.
Yeah, there's just something about the way they move. Like, it's just,
I don't know what you guys were looking up, because most of what I found were adorable videos of baby sloths and adult sloths hugging people.
Have you seen their claws? They're terrifying.
They use them for good.
Well, really?
That's how they fool us. That's how they fool us, but they do.
What was the last good thing a sloth did? Tell me.
They hugged someone in a video.
I would not want to get hugged by a sloth.
You know what they didn't show, though, is that right after they stopped recording the video, it took off that dude's head.
Exactly. Yep. Exactly.
You know, the guy from Lord of Illusions, how he got stabbed with the swords? That's what it looked like, with the paws going into the person.
There was actually a sloth up there on the rafters, like, plucking the strings that were attached to the swords.
Oh, no.
So they'd fall out of sync and stab the dude.
A sloth is Kaiser Soze.
Whoa. Spoiler alert.
Hold the press.
Mark, you had one more listener question for us, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Does it have anything to do with sloths?
No, it does not. Thank gosh.
Yeah. I know.
So we got this one from Facebook. And once again, Lacey, she gave us some wonderful questions. And we got one more. It is famous meals in movies. And so I got thinking about it. You know, I was thinking about Cool Hand Luke with the 50 hard-boiled eggs. I was thinking about in Bridesmaid, she makes that delicious cake and raccoons get an amazing meal when her love interest doesn't eat it. You got the Breakfast Club. You got Pee-wee's Big Adventure when he dances in the restaurant. But I came up with a delicious meal, and it is the 50-year-old McAllen from Skyfall, right? The Timpano from Big Night, the Ratatouille from Ratatouille. Then I got the $5 milkshake from Pulp Fiction. And then in Coffee and Cigarettes, Bill Murray's working at this coffee shop with he goes and serves the RZA coffee. So Bill Murray comes, serves me coffee, and then I got a wafer-thin mint from the Monty Python movie.
Wow. So you actually planned out an entire pretty much 7-course meal.
And I would explode because of the wafer-thin mint.
Wow. I'm impressed. That actually sounds delicious.
I know, it would be an amazing meal.
I got to tell you, I picked three things. You covered two of them in your multi-course meal, but I've got one.
Oh, no.
That's the shrimp salad facial attack from Beetlejuice. when the shrimp salads turn into hands that reach out and grab them by the face.
I'd still eat them. I don't care what you guys say. Shrimp is delicious.
You would have ace-palmed.
Hey.
And what about Hannibal when Ray Liotta gets his brain eaten?
There's that. Yeah, I had that too. I forgot about that. That was kind of funny too, because he's sitting there. He's all like super medicated, and his skull cap is off. Oh, that's good. He's kind of out of it. He's eating his own brain. Oh, that's good. He has no idea what he's eating.
Well, speaking of brains, I think my pick is the Temple of Doom dinner scene.
the chilled monkey brain?
Yeah, the chilled monkey brains, the eyeball soup, the snake surprise? Come on.
And no matter what people say about Hook nowadays, that meal was awesome with the Lost Boys.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. It was all colorful. It was like balls of mousse and ice cream and stuff, mostly.
It was like gelato, but not cold.
And a few turkey legs.
Now, if I was a Viking, that'd be ideal. Just turkey legs.
Turkey legs. That's what Vikings eat. Turkey legs and mead.
That's how they got so big and mean.
Yep. Hey, speaking of Vikings, Mark, you wrote an article pertaining to 95 Week about 95's jerks, right?
Wait, are you saying that Vikings are jerks?
Most of them were. I mean, you can't just pillage and rape without being a jerk, right?
Yeah.
And they had when you use that choice of words, no, they're jerks.
And you know, like Vikings knew when there was parties at coastal villages. They knew when a lot of people would be in town. So I guess, all right, that's fair enough. Yeah, so, you know, 95, there was a lot of troubled youth. There was a lot of weird horror movies, and there was a lot of jerks. And so I guess when, you know, Levengood and I have talked about this before, we talk about cinematic jerks. So just imagine Biff from Back in the Future, or Bill Paxton, Chet from Weird Science. Now, these aren't guys that are going to kill you. They're not going to take over the world. They're just going to be a pain in the butt, and they're just going to cause some annoyance or slight discomfort. And as I was looking through the 95 posts, I found a lot of jerks. And let's jump right in to Ben Affleck as Shannon from Mallrats. So he worked at Fashionable Male. He liked to do stuff in uncomfortable places that weren't Volkswagens. He gets arrested, and Kevin Smith summed up Ben Affleck's career really well, his early career. And Kevin Smith was like, "You were just a guy who would beat ass all the time." And he was just like this elitist. He beat up the comic book nerds, and he was just like dazed and confused. He was a jerk. So Ben Affleck started his career off as just a total jerk.
You know,
How did he go down in that movie?
Well, he had sex with an underage woman. They showed the video, then he got arrested.
Yeah. No good.
No.
No good.
Affleck was at his best when he's just, like, really jerky, you know? He was born to be a jerk.
Brody in this film. Yeah, he just wasn't – he was a jerk. He was a straight-up jerk.
Like, in the movies where I have to, you know, feel for him or, like, he's the hero, I have a hard time doing it because in the back of my head I'm thinking, like, Dazed and Confused, Mallrats. Like, this guy's just a jerk. I don't want to root for him, but I have to. Why?
And then he goes to movies like Paycheck. Ugh. Remember that movie? That's another movie you forget about.
I don't know. I still have mixed feelings about him as Batman. Like, he's always going to be that jerk to me. Now he's going to be wearing the cowl.
Yeah, but think about him from The Town, though. I'd like to think he redeemed a lot. He's grown up.
No. Yeah.
He's still a jerk to me.
He's still that guy.
In fact, his pull-up scene in The Town, that could have been Batman doing pull-ups.
I feel like that's the most gratuitous pull-up scene in the history of scenes.
Gratuitous pull-up scene?
Because it wasn't needed. It just kind of like...
Linda Hamilton in Terminator 2, that was legit. It showed that she'd been training, that she was getting ready for something serious. Ben Affleck, it's like, I'm pretty ripped. Hey, director, which is me, I'm going to take off my shirt. Hey, Ben Affleck, can I take off my shirt? Yeah, Ben Affleck, go ahead and take off your shirt. That was the conversation he had with himself.
I hope the whole crew had to hear that, too.
He had the conversation in front of a mirror with his shirt off.
I remember watching that scene and going, oh, brother.
You know, I will say... Bruce Wayne, a.k.a. Batman, he's a huge jerk himself. So maybe Ben Affleck is perfect for Batman.
Maybe it's Shannon. He learned a lot of skills in prison, and then he sued somebody, made millions, and he became Batman.
Yeah, that could work. Yeah.
We'll see. So our second jerk is Roach from Demon Knight. Now, we've already covered Demon Knight, but Thomas Hayden Church, I love him. He's in Sideways. He's a big jerk in that. I love him. But I love in this movie, like, he's a bad guy, yes. He's not a good dude. But imagine if a couple demons bust into your house and, I don't know, if you're a jerk and Billy Zane is trying to corrupt you by giving you stuff, you're going to fall for it. So I don't think he was evil. I just think he was a jerk that was in the wrong place at the wrong time. And he had that weird scene where he spits at the demons and then the demons go and blow his hair back. And then William Sadler's like, they don't like that. But, I mean, who likes getting spit at?
Demons.
Demon? Yeah, spit battles?
You know,
or the people from Ace Ventura?
His character is like the kind of character we come across a couple every season in The Walking Dead for the people who watch The Walking Dead. He's one of those jerk characters you come across and you're like, I just know right away he's going to be trouble. He's going to get someone killed. And you don't think he's going to get killed right away. You think he's going to get somebody killed. He's that guy.
Yeah, and he got a lot of people killed in this film. And that's what the classic jerk does, though. They move the script through there. Without him, they probably would have been safe, but he wipes stuff up, he falls for it, he gets them all to death. So that's the classic jerk is just the guy who's just moves the plot along. And so our next jerk is Debo from Friday. And I think he's one of the best cinematic jerks in the history of the planet because he's the big jerk. He's the big dude that bullies and threatens and, like, you know, the whole area, you know, they hate him, but they can't do anything about it because he's just such a big dude. And he throws uppercuts that knock people into the stratosphere. And he's such a jerk that it makes the ending fight scene great, which I wrote about, where Craig and Debo fight. It's like this believable fight where he gets knocked out by a brick. And it was just like, he's like the jerk that you learn a moral from.
The jerk you learn a moral from. There you go.
Like, it's like, you know, you use your hands. You don't need the guns to be the man. You know, you don't need a gun to be a man. And so, like, Debo kind of he was kind of like this Goliath type. And, you know, Craig, Ice Cube, had to step up and face him man to man.
What kind of moral do you think, what kind of morals do you think Ben Affleck's jerks taught?
Not to sleep with 16-year-olds like Ewan McGregor did in Trainspotting.
That's true.
That's right.
I liked how that Tiny Zeus Lister, the guy who played Debo, I liked how he came from playing like all these crazy roles, like in No Holds Barred way before that with Hulk Hogan. He played like just an angry wrestler. But in The Fifth Element, he plays the president.
Oh, I love it.
And it's like, if you could watch that for the first time, because I've seen it like 50 times now, I think. If you could see that for the first time, when you first see Tiny Zeus Lister, this movie came out in the 90s, and, you know, just a couple years after Friday, you'd think he's going to fight someone. But he never does. He always wears his suit. He's the president. He stays presidential. I felt like that was so ironically funny.
No, it was great. And I love the casting. You know, it was like a Friday reunion with him and Chris Tucker.
Oh, yeah. Wow. And that never occurred to me before. I gotta watch that movie again.
Yeah, and I love that movie, Fifth Element. Oh my gosh! So speaking of Fifth Element, that leads us to Billy Madison.
Speaking of Fifth Element,
I can see the connection there. Yeah.
Now Eric Gordon is the traditional jerk that makes the slacker become a man. He's the become a man jerk, where. You know, he blackmails, cheats, and threatens his way into running this hotel company. And he's just this massive jerk that will get the company unless the main character steps up and becomes a man. And the reason I added him is because there's this scene where the jerk's name is Eric in the film. And there's this really nice guy, Carl. And there's a scene where Carl's like, I ate some Triscuit crackers in the car. You should have had some. And Eric's like, well, maybe if you told me they were delicious Triscuit crackers, I would have enjoyed them with you. And Carl goes, I'm sorry. Then Eric goes, well, sorry doesn't put the Triscuit crackers in my stomach now, does it, Carl? But I like that at the end of it, he adds Carl. Like, that's such a jerk move. Like, does it, Carl? Like, he's the worst. He intimidates kids. He's just the classic, you gotta rise above everyone jerk.
I think it's funny that in 1995 he was playing this like mega jerk, and then in 1995 he started like an 8-year run playing like the nicest, sweetest guy in The West Wing.
Yeah, dude, dude's a great. I love him as an actor. I think he's hilarious, but he was just the. You know, I feel like Billy Madison mastered the jerk there for a while with like Shooter McGavin.
Oh yeah!
Oh god! Yeah, from Happy Gilmore.
Yeah. Like he was like the man child that had to kind of become a man because of this jerk. And so this leads us into the next one, which is Rex Manning from Empire Records. And I wrote a post about this movie. It's a cult classic. It's lived on through the ages, and it's lived so long because of Rex Manning. And I mean, 20 years later, there's still Rex Manning days. And in this film, there's this wash-up pop star named Rex Manning who comes to do a signing at Empire Records. And the whole store unites. A lot of people are in line to see this guy. Liv Tyler's in love with him. Renee Zellweger has a crush on him. But he is the biggest jerk. And I think what makes him the biggest jerk is he has a song called Say No More, Mon Amour, Mon Amour, Say No More, Mon Amour. It's the worst song in the history of the planet. And he has the weirdest hair. He has a very wavy hair. He's just like the big, I remember watching this movie and hating him so much. Like, he's like the jerk that made you realize that you are still like a young person. And that there's really evil out there in the world. Like,
wow.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, he's the jerk that crushes your hopes and kind of makes you grow up a little bit.
Wow.
I got to say, I kind of like that little music video.
of Sam Montemore.
Yeah, if you look at the webpage, you know, I have a gif of him doing a sassy little sachet. And you know, I mean, it's,
I saw that gif. I swear to God, I thought it was John Schneider from Smallville and Dukes of Hazzard.
Oh yeah,
I really thought it was him. I went on IMDb to confirm, and it wasn't. But I was so sure from that gif that it was John Schneider.
And like, I don't know. I love Empire Records. I think it's just a great cult classic. And part of that reason was Rex Manning being such a jerk and making everybody grow up in the process. Like, he's like a great plot device. He's the plot device jerk. And so that leads us into our next jerk, which is Rick Sanford from Angus, who was James Vanderbeek. And he's the classic high school jerk where he's this, for some reason, he's this athletic, good-looking kid. He has a girlfriend, but he has a terrible home life, so he's just an absolute jerk to the main star. And then instead of this guy kind of coming around, the entire school rallied against him. So he's a jerk that makes hundreds of people hate him. And, like, he's the guy that pushes you at prom. He's, like, the really just angry high school jerk.
I feel like this role was training him for his later sitcom career in, like, Friends with Better Lives and Don't Trust the Bee in Apartment 23, where he plays, like, just a full-of-himself, over-entitled kind of jerk.
Yeah, and, like, he had an edge in this film, and then he kind of went to the Creek, and then that typecasted him, and then he had bad accents in Varsity Blues, and now he's kind of become Vanderbeek.
I love Vanderbeek.
Dude, the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers R-rated film that he just acted in.
That was pretty cool. I liked it.
That was also pretty random, but yeah, it was pretty cool.
And then that leads us into the greatest Power Ranger of all time, which is Rob Lowe as there Paul from Tommy Boy. Now, he's not a Power Ranger, but he doesn't age. I mean, he looks younger now than he does 20 years ago. But I love Paul, the guy from this film, Tommy Boy. I love Paul from this. I love his opening shot where he slaps a glass when the kid's making the face on there. He'll whap a kid in the face. He'll lie to a family. But the thing I think most funny, what I like about him is he kind of rolls with Tommy for a while. They go out in their car. They try to go cow tipping. He rinses Tommy off. He you know, asks him if he eats paint chips as a kid. And so he's like the classic sneaky jerk that at the end you figure out after you've sort of become a man. And it's too late because that jerk has already gotten his way.
I'm just kind of realizing something. This is the second 1995 jerk that was an extremely likable, sweet, nice character in The West Wing.
Yeah.
He was, in fact, he might have been the absolute nicest, sweetest guy of all the characters in The West Wing.
So wait, what was it about The West Wing that just attracts all these 1995 jerks and just spits them out as like really likable guys?
But not just likable guys, like the most likable guys on television.
Maybe Aaron Sorkin just has really magical powers. Like, he could just make anybody likable. Maybe he just went at like a 1995 jerk movie marathon and he was like, you know what, I want to make these guys likable.
You know what? You know what? Bill Pullman had a history of playing, or not Bill Pullman, Jeff Daniels had a history of playing super likable characters. And then he was on the pilot for The Newsroom, which was by Aaron Sorkin. And in the pilot of The Newsroom, he was a super mega jerk. Yep. But then all the rest of the episodes, even while he's a jerk, he's also super nice and likable and sweet. A jerk at the same time. So at that point, Aaron Sorkin learned how to find the happy medium between jerkiness and being sweet.
He's like the jerk that's like the father figure jerk. That's like, you know, I know it's right, so it's going to be tough love.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, and then that leads us to Lolita from Welcome to the Dollhouse. And I just want, like, this movie is incredibly gawky. It's a bonkers film, a lot of troubled youth. But there's this girl named Lolita, and she makes the life for our main character, Don Wiener, terrible. But the one scene I just want to talk about as we move along is there's this one scene where Don goes, "Why do you hate me?" And then Lolita goes, "Because you're ugly." She's like the middle school jerk that you have to get past in your formative years to become a stronger person. And like, but she is the worst. She's the worst out of all these jerks because she's just evil incarnate.
She was like the Super Mario Brothers level one Koopa. Because when you first got the near Nintendo and Super Mario Brothers, you would do level one like 20 or 30 times before you could jump over Koopa and hit the thing, and then he's dead and the bridge breaks. But then, like, after you finally beat him the first time in level one, like, all the other levels, like, they just take one or two tries.
Yep. So if, like, yeah, if you get, I love it. She is the first. She is the first level Koopa. If you can get past her, you're stronger. However, if you can't get past her and something happens to where, I'm not saying this leads to it, but let's say, you know, she depresses you, you gain a lot of weight.
Stress eating.
Yeah, and then you meet Tony Perkis from Heavyweights, who is Ben Stiller's character. He's my final jerk of 95. And I love this line from him where he's like, "Attention campers, lunch has been canceled due to lack of hustle. Deal with it."
Because it's a fat camp. That's so cruel.
Yeah, and like, he's just the worst. He is and I think he wanted to be uncredited in this film, but you can see that this character led to his character in Dodgeball. So it was obviously something. I don't know. Maybe he made, you know, he directed Reality Bites a year before, so he wanted to be associated with this film. But he was a jerk in Happy Gilmore too.
So I've got to go next level nerd on this, but so in that movie, he's like super fit, right? I mean, Ben Stiller in general has a history of being in great shape, but I mean, his character's obsessed with fitness. He's trying to get these fat kids thin to legitimize himself, you know, in the eyes of, I guess, his investors or something, right? So he's trying to make decisions to make the kids thinner. As it turns out, if you take three meals in a day, and they're the same number of calories and carbs and all that, but you eat the biggest meal at dinner, you're going to gain fat. If you eat the biggest meal at breakfast and the smallest meal at dinner, you're going to lose fat, even though you're eating the same stuff over the course of the day. So when you skip lunch and then starve the body and then give the kids dinner, any given dinner is going to put more fat on their bodies than it would if they had lunch.
That's way more
so what he was doing would scientifically make the kids fatter than if he let them have lunch and didn't starve them and train their bodies to store fat more efficiently.
So he's the uneducated jerk.
Uneducated he's the jerk. Antithesis of personal trainers.
Personal trainer jerk.
That,
and then he
was
later
sense. That just makes sense somehow.
He was blinded by his jerkiness.
Or maybe he knew. Maybe he knew all along. He just wanted to keep him fat so he could just keep yelling at him and making fun of him. You know? I don't know.
To keep his self-esteem up?
Yeah. Why not? That's what
heavyweight
jerks do.
Fan fiction?
That's what jerks do.
Oh, yeah. I love it. So, hey, do we have time for one more question? I just want to get this one out there.
I think we got time. Let's do a question.
Go for it.
So we had one more question that we haven't covered. This is by Jonathan. I like this. I like this a lot. He asked, "Why does this is from Facebook as well?" He's like, "Why does everyone think that Donnie Darko was an amazing movie?"
Oh, little controversy.
Right. Now, okay, I'm like maybe the one person out of the three of us, and including most of our listeners, who's only seen Donnie Darko once, and I saw it way back when it came out, so it's not that fresh to me.
I think I've seen it thrice. So,
like, I remember seeing this movie. I remember thinking, yeah, that's a cool movie. Like, that's pretty cool. And then later, just year after year after year, every passing year, I'd hear more people talking about it than the year before. And before I knew it, it was like I was in a cult, and I just believed that it was this awesome thing, but I never went back and watched it again. So I almost feel like hearing people say it's the best thing since sliced bread for the last, you know, 20 years is going to make me look back on it and be disappointed.
You know what I think it was? Now, I watched this back in, I don't know, 2001, 2002. And as soon as it was done, I went on my dial-up modem and went and read Roger Ebert's review. And I went looking on forums and chat boards, which I never did, to talk about the film and the ending. I think it's one of those films that, you know, when you watched it, there was internet, but it wasn't that day and age yet of just Twitter and everyone sharing their thoughts about it. So this became sort of a homegrown success. And the way I got my hand on this movie was someone let me borrow the DVD. And I think it was like DVD sharing. And so it built this kind of underground appreciation for it. And also Donnie, when Jake Gyllenhaal was in his full, Holden Caulfield, Catcher in the Rye, mode of just troubled youth, he was like this suburban kid who had understanding parents and he still had his problems. You know, he had like a kind of a goth type style, but he still had a girlfriend. I think a lot of kids maybe in the suburbs and around related to it because it wasn't, you know, they could relate to this kid who lived in the suburbs and I don't know, and it had enough questions. I mean, was he schizophrenic? I mean, was he supernaturally powered? I mean, did the events really even happen? I think there's just so many questions in this film that it and that aren't ended, that aren't explained, and they led to discussions. And there, you know, it bombed in the box office. We worked in the theater after 2001, and nobody went to the movies, and so it kind of became this movie that I think people started to really embrace and own. And I think that's why people feel like it's theirs with Joss Whedon's work or Mallrats or Empire Records. It's like these cults have kind of kept them alive, not the cults from Paranormal Activity. But I think it's just gained and gained and gained in notoriety. And those same people that loved it back then are the same people that are really proclaiming it on social media today.
So you're saying it just really – one of the big reasons why it got its cult status is – it came out just the right time when the internet was just starting to take off, right? It got kind of a – it had viral marketing before viral marketing even was a term, right?
Yeah. And, I mean, much like I got my hands on Boondock Saints because someone let me borrow it. It was just these movies that failed initially. And I think when movies do fail and they find an audience later, those people really embrace that film. And they were very vocal about it because they felt that it had been underappreciated. And, you can see how it relates to outsiders. It's not a total outsider movie because the kid does come from, like, a nice home and his parents are actually pretty cool. I think there's a lot to relate to in this film. And the soundtrack.
Can I ask? So I haven't seen this in 15 or 20 years. Wasn't there something about the ending that made it seem like the story created a loop? Am I remembering that right? Something with a plane crash or?
Yeah.
How did that go?
Oh, gosh.
Like there was a plane crash that started a set of events, but then at the end of that set of events that were started by the plane crash, you see that plane crashing. Wasn't it something like that?
Hold on, let me get – Let me boot up my dial-up modem and let me out.
No, but those are the questions I had. Now, like, you know, in the beginning, the engine fell on the house, but they couldn't find the plane. And then that opened up, it started talking about the transience of human existence.
All right. I think we need to watch this movie and discuss it in the next month in another episode.
And see,
it's happened.
That's why I think it's been a cult classic, though, is because it's opened up a discussion and people love it. And I think – I don't know. I think the character people love, and I just think that's why people love the film. I do think the audience isn't as big as we think because of, you know, the vocal minority on the internet.
Yeah.
But the
vocal minority for this movie is perhaps the movie geek majority on the internet.
Yeah, and so there's a much larger presence. It's like when everybody thought Snakes on a Plane was going to make $1 billion.
Yeah.
But it flopped at the box office.
Well, let me ask you guys this. If Donnie Darko had come out today, how do you think it would have been received? Would it have achieved its cult status, do you think?
I think it would have been more of a sleeper hit than a cult classic. Like Napoleon Dynamite, can we classify that as a...
Oh, yeah, it's cult. It's a cult hit.
But it made like $70 million at the box office.
I think cult hits can also be box office successes. You know, Napoleon Dynamite, it was just one of those movies that just came out of nowhere.
I guess everybody saw it once, but no one's really watched it more than that except for the really loyal fan base.
Yeah.
I think it's a – I mean, Primer came out. People really read about that. I think – you know what? It would be like in It Follows, I think. I think – it would be trumpeted a lot. Everybody, you know, according to the internet, It Follows was going to be the biggest thing ever, but it made $3.7 million this weekend, which isn't that much. So I think it would just be like it is now, just the vocal minority applauding it.
Wait, now, I mean, everyone knew that It Follows would be popular, but it started with an irregularly limited release. And then just last week, they expanded it, I think.
Yeah, it went to about 1,500 screens, but it still only made 3.7. Yeah. So that's not like – but every major press, you know, Grantland, AV Club, Vulture, EW, all the big websites were trumpeting how great it was, and it's been everywhere. But 3.7 million is not that much.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I don't know what their budget was either, but I think that they'll do well in the long run. It's a really cool, different movie.
I just want to point out that what's his name, Richard Kelly, right? I just want to make sure that's right. Yeah, his his follow up movie, Southland Tales. That was garbage. No one's gonna disagree with me. Yeah, that movie was just garbage. It was just terrible.
Holy that really God. Is one of few movies that I wished I could unsee.
And I think.
I think he fell too in love with himself. And Donnie Darko, I love it because he got paired up when he was really young with this great DP who really talked him through the shots. And it's like this great visual film with this young kid. And it felt like a very pure film, like same as Boondock Saints and a lot of these cult classics. They're just pure movies. And Southland Tales was not.
No, it was not pure at all. All right, I think that was a really good question. Thanks again to our listener, Jonathan.
And Lacey.
Yeah, and Lacey. And I think this is a good time to start wrapping up the podcast, guys. It's about that time. Actually, it's a little bit past that time, but who's keeping count? All right, guys, before we sign off, time for plugs.
Yeah, guys, come visit the site, www.moviesfilmsflicks.com. Check out all the latest Fast and the Furious, It Follows coverage, and come by and ask this. You know, I don't know. I got nothing.
Moviesfilmsflicks.com.
Yeah.
Also, check out sharkjumper.com. It's the home of this podcast and other fine podcasts available from Sharkjumper Studios. There's also a link to our Patreon page. Oh, also, real quick, I'll tell you, we're coming out with a brand new podcast that's going to be exclusive to our Patreon supporters. It's going to be called Swimming Lessons, a podcast about David Schwimmer. Anything and everything related to David Schwimmer, me and my Sharkjumper colleagues, Robin and Kyle, will discuss how good was he in Band of Brothers? Was it really right for him to go on a break? Also, we'll discuss his appearance on the 1998 sitcom, The Single Guy. So check that out.
What? It's the worst idea ever.
That's what we were
maybe going back for. In 1995.
All right, guys. For my co-host, Mark Hoffmeyer.
See ya.
And John Levengood.
Good night. May Kurt Russell be with you.
I've been your host, John Lossworth, and we'll see you guys next time.
Peace.
Later.
T-minus 5 seconds till shark drop. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Drop the shark! Go! Go! Go!
This podcast is a Sharkjumper Studios production.